Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Richard Hickey joins us, telling us about new FAA lighting standards being enforced by the FCC. Some of these standards could lower broadcasters' compliance costs, but others may cost you more. Chris Tobin joins me and Richard Hickey from Highlights, Inc. on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you by the Axia IP Audio Driver. It lets you send and record single or multiple channels of PC audio directly to and from Axia networks over Ethernet. By Direct Current, the weekly broadcast technical newsletter from the Telos Alliance. And by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, delighted that you're here. I'm in a different studio than usual, aren't I? I'm on a little holiday, and my friend Roger very, very graciously donates his studio for me to do this podcast when I'm out of town and on the East Coast. So here I am. I'm in the Eastern time zone along with, both of the other people on the show. This is This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about technology, everything from a $14 microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And in fact, today we really are talking about the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the light bulbs going up the tower in between. So hang on. That is coming up. Let me bring in our co-host. He's here almost every week, about as often as I am, from the East Coast, the New York City area, Chris Tobin. Chris, welcome in. Glad you're here, buddy.
Well, thank you, Kirk. I'm in a multi-track recording studio. You can see the Sony console behind me and a Mac operating with, Pro Tools and stuff. So, yeah, it's fun. It's a time of year just to travel about. I try not to be stationary in one place. It's good. Show people different things. It's fun. And I'm on some broadband connection. I'm not sure of how well it's going to work. We'll see. I'm using my Audio-Technica USB microphone for those who are interested in knowing what we're doing. And my classic, the C920 webcam from Logitech. It's going on 5 years old and still produces video that apparently is complimentary. That's what I'm told.
It sure is. You know, and that camera seems to do well with outdoor lighting, because when you appear to us from outdoors, it's amazingly good. So yes. bright light, I guess, is good. I had a C920 from Logitech that died. It just crapped out. It just wouldn't work anymore. I bought the C930 and didn't like it nearly as much. The C930 has a wider field of vision, so I guess it's better for actual conference meetings and such. I never could get the colors and balance to look right. It was very sensitive to light. So
I think that model, they optimized it for teleconferencing. So they assumed the lighting would be typical at an office, fluorescence, yeah. Blue scale type of lighting, color registration. The C920, I have to say, yes, you give it a lot of light and the sensor works really well. I'm in somewhat subdued track lighting. I don't have it fully bright. Maybe I'll try it halfway through the show. It still works pretty well. I mean, it's a little soft lens looking, so it's not bad. But I have to say it's probably the best one I've used so far, the C920.
I went back. I bought another C920, so that's what I'm on now is that C920. Got to get used to the width not being – I kind of need to be farther back from it than with this, with a 930, you got to get closer to it. With the 920, yeah. You got to get farther back to get the picture.
No,
right.
I think the 920 gives you a nice workable perspective, focal length. I mean, I'm about 3 feet from the camera right now to give you this view that you see behind me and stuff. But it's very easy to work with. I like it. I'm not a fan of the 930 as far as this application. Conference rooms or meetings with multiple people, absolutely. But for this, nah, I'd stick with this one.
Good deal. Well, that's a lot of inside baseball. So
absolutely, but that's what people tune in for.
Yeah, that's true. That is, you're right. That's what people tune in for. Sure enough. All right. Hey, let's bring in our guest. I met this gentleman a few months ago at an SBE meeting in Nashville, and I'm not sure if we had ever met before that. Richard Hickey, welcome in. How are you today, sir?
Great. Thanks. How are you, Kirk?
I'm terrific, and it's good to see your face on my show. That makes me proud that you'd come on. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a little taste of what we're going to be finding out. You work with a company called Highlights, H-I-L-I-G-H-T-S, High, H-I, and then Lights. And you guys have something to do with towers and lighting and big stuff and important things with steel and electricity and photons. Tell me what you guys do at Highlights.
Yeah, it's basically our primary line of work is service for tall tower lighting systems and electricals. Both Tim Nash, the owner of the company, and myself worked many years ago for Flash Technology. And wow. So I've got about 20 years in the business, and Tim has got, 22, 23 years altogether out there as well. So plus we've got a complimentary staff out here that's lots of experience in the business, lots of exposure in the business. But yeah, for the most part, it's tall tower lighting systems. Repair, maintain, install.
Well, what you've been going around to SBE meetings and chapters and talking, and you appearing on our show, because there have been some FAA rule changes about lighting, and that's what we're going to get into. Isn't that right? People need to be aware of these changes.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there are a lot of questions on this, a lot of confusion. The FAA issued a new lighting guideline. Of course, that's their advisory circular, or AC 70/7460-1L. It's the first one that they've issued in a number of years, since 2002, basically. But a lot of changes in there, things that built up. The FAA and FCC, along with the Fish and Wildlife Service, actually worked on this edition and came up with some guidelines that were good for the tower owners and good for the wildlife, the migratory birds as well. So a lot of changes. A lot of those are not retroactive, but we'll tell you where you can benefit by changing your tower regulations yourself.
Good deal. I'm looking forward to hearing about that here in just a few minutes. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, by the way, we're at episode 313. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Axia. Now, you know, I work for the Telos Alliance, so yeah, I have a biased opinion, but that also means I have some knowledge, inside knowledge, about Axia. And today I want to tell you about something, one of the unsung heroes of audio over IP, and that is the IP audio driver. The driver. This is software that goes into a computer. Typically, it's going to be a Windows computer, but there's also drivers available for Linux. And we've had a beta version for OS 10 for a long time. And I think the company Axia is going to end up making that a real product and finally bring it out of beta. But the IP audio driver, and you can look at more about that on the website at telosalliance.com. Click on Axia and then slide down and find you the IP audio driver. What does it do? Well, this is pretty amazing. How many times have you worked with an automation computer or any computer that's recording professional audio in your broadcast plant, in your radio station, and you've got an internal sound card with funky connectors because, you know, you've just got that IBM slot to deal with as far as width. You can't have an XLR connector there on the back plane of the PC. So it usually goes into some kind of umbilical or a pigtail cord, right, that comes out to XLRs for the really professional models. Or maybe you've got quarter-inch tip ring sleeve connectors, or maybe they're just RCA connectors, or maybe it's on a D-sub-9 or D-sub-15 connector. Hard to deal with. And you've also got the noisy electrical environment of a PC with all these clocks going around, square waves, and just noise. So it's actually a little tough to build a really quiet sound card into a PC. Well, Axia, using audio over IP from day one. I mean, Axia had this driver out since the early, early days of audio over IP for broadcasters. What you do is you just put a second network interface card into your PC. So you've got an automation PC. You've got one that's recording production, you know, things that you do your production on. And so you put a second network card in there, and that's going to be for your Axia network. Now you've got a PC that can connect to the Axia network, and then you run this driver. What does the driver do? What does the driver? Well, here's how I describe it. The Axia IP audio driver, and I'll kind of whisper this, it persuades the Windows operating system that there's another sound card inside. It says, hey, I'm a sound card. That's right. You can treat me just like the built-in motherboard sound card, or just like that Darla or Turtle Beach or whatever card that you're used to dealing with. I'm a sound card too. And by the way, my name is Axia Livewire. So now the Windows operating system believes there's another sound card there. And so it works just like any other sound card. You can pull audio from it. You can push audio to it. And you're really pulling and pushing to and from the the Axia Livewire network, because you're hooked up to the network interface. That, remember that second NIC that you put in there. So what does a network interface cost? You can buy them for $15 or less. So to buy a good quality NIC, okay, I think sometimes I might pay $25 for one. But $25 and the Axia IP audio driver, and you've got stereo in, stereo out from any Windows PC. There's another thing you can do. There's also a multi-channel version of the IP driver. You can actually, I think we've tested this up to 32 stereo ins and outs. Typically, you might stop at 24. A lot of folks stop at 8 or 16 because there can be a lot of data in and out. You got to have a really good gigabit card to handle that much audio streaming in and out of your PC. But this makes it so easy to hook up a PC. And the last benefit is this. You know, you need GPIO on a lot of PCs, you know, an automation system. You want to tell it to start, tell it to skip to the next thing. You want it to tell you, hey, I'm at the end of this event, or here's a contact closure that you might need for something. Well, the IP audio driver has GPIO built into it. So now you're receiving GPIs or GPOs. Yeah, anyway, you're getting closures from the network, and you're sending closures out over the network, over that same network card, and other Axia gear on the network can deal with that. You can pick it up and have a physical closure somewhere, or you can send it a closure, a physical or a virtual one, and have it show up in the PC. So many possibilities. And here's what I really like. Instead of having a pigtail and a bunch of wires and DB this and D-sub that connectors and just all that mess, you've got exactly one cable, and it's an RJ45. And that's it. That takes care of it. So, my goodness, why wouldn't you do this? Check it out on the web. Talk to your friends that may have Axia in there. I've got a bunch of these drivers running at my radio stations, and I've certainly seen them all over the world as well. It really works. The Axia IP audio driver. Just one more thing that makes audio over IP an absolute no-brainer to do, and do it from Axia and Livewire. Now, with AES-67 built into several products. All right, we are talking to Richard Hickey with Highlights. Chris Tobin is along with us too. He's in some highfalutin fancy recording studio, a multi-track place. And Chris, there in the New York City area, my goodness, you've got towers and tower lights galore, especially out in the Meadowlands, don't you?
Yes, in the Meadowlands, we have all the AM towers and lots of lights. And one of the sites I maintain, Four Times Square, has tower lights on it as well. So yeah, in the Empire State Building when I did work there as well. And let's see. Anything above 200 feet pretty much in the city. But yeah, there's a lot of tower lights around. And strobes. Lights, red, the traditional red lights everyone's familiar with, but the daytime or daylight stuff with the strobes that people are not probably familiar with.
So let's bring Richard back in. Richard, I know this all these rule changes, there's a lot of stuff in there. You sent me a PowerPoint that you normally give to SBE chapters, and it's long. There's a lot of stuff to digest there. Where do you want to start with the highlights of what folks need to know about some new rules?
Well, of course, to begin with, let's talk about where the responsibilities lie. The one thing that a lot of people don't realize is in 17.6 CFR, and I'm going to spout off a few of these. If anyone has questions after the show, we can always get the information to you, and I'll be glad to provide that. And 17.49, the FCC actually says the tower owner and all tenants and licensees bear responsibility and upkeep the proper reporting and logging for the tower lighting systems. Now, if you've got an owner that's a very conscientious owner of the structure, you're pretty well covered, and that's 90% of the cases. But if you've got an abandonment situation where the owner walks away, is not taking care of their responsibilities, the FCC can reach around that owner and come to you as the tenant or licensee. So it's good to know these rules and regulations, especially as they come out. So again, the new regulations were a joint effort. The primary push on that was from the Migratory Bird Conservancy people to bring out migratory birds are actually drawn to steady burn red lighting. Flashing, not so much, but red is primary color for the birds, and the steady burn is, of course, as they stay on it, because the birds more naturally to that situation. So the again, the AC-70/7460-1L was released December 4th of 2015. And a lot of people, of course, see a new AC come out and they say, oh my gosh, I've got to run out and change all the lighting on my portfolio. That's not the case. The determination for your particular tower was issued when you got the ASN, or the determination letter from the FAA. If you look at that determination, it will spell out which version of the 7460-1. It could be a K version, it could be J, it could be earlier. The L is the latest version. So if it was one of those earlier issues, you don't have to change because the new rules came out. There are only a couple of new rules in this AC that apply to you as an existing owner.
Hey, so, Richard, I want to stop you real quick. One thing we try to do here is explain to novices, and sometimes myself, I forget what they stand for. And I just remembered AC. You've referred to that several times. That stands for advisory circular, right? That's the FAA's way of putting this information out there. Sounds gentle, but an AC carries the weight of some law, doesn't it? You've got to comply with it, right?
Yes, as a matter of fact, with CFR 47 that was passed, it's federal mandate, so it is an actual act of Congress that gives the FCC the authority, FAA as the governing body, as the rule maker, if you will, for the lighting for towers. So everything, though it looks advisory or suggestion in nature in the AC, it's actually law for the FCC.
Okay. Just want to make sure, because if I read an advisory circular, I'm thinking, oh, here's some nice suggestions about how to make my tower look pretty and help airplanes avoid it. No, this is what you got to do. It's spelled out here.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Please continue. Yeah, you were on the migratory birds, and I was just looking through what you sent me here. And holy cow, this looks complicated. I think most people, certainly I would need somebody like you to help me wade through this and understand what it says in my instrument of authorization.
Right. And we're glad to do that. It's, there are a number of places you can go, but we, of course, are one of the places we're more than happy to help people understand this as we go. Some of the major changes that you see on here and some of the situations I would avoid as a tower owner and some of the ones I would jump on as a tower owner. So again, let's think steady burn lighting. So that's red at night. Because the only example where red lighting is allowed as a marking for a tower is at night. It's not acceptable as a day marking. Doesn't mean you can't run it in the day. It just means it's not acceptable as a day marking. So in the range from basically some of the red systems started 150 feet with medium intensity lighting. From 150 feet to 350, the new regulations say, provided you must flash that beacon, top beacon, at 27 to 33 flashes a minute or 30 flashes a minute plus or minus 3. The marker lights, the side smaller L810 marker lights, must flash now in synchronized fashion with that medium intensity beacon on top. So that's a situation I would try to avoid. Those markers, most were not designed for flashing. A lot of the older systems were not designed to meet that 30 flashes per minute requirement. So you may have to change out an entire system if you want to go to that. So that's a situation I may want to avoid unless you see a lot of bird kill with migratory birds. And then, of course, it's a good fiduciary duty to jump into this. But on the towers, the structures, existing towers above 350 feet, now we're talking a savings, because what you can do on those structures, these are the A2s, E2s, F2s up to 2,000, actually 2,200 feet. On that red night lighting is if you can hit that 30 flash per minute plus or minus 3 realm, you can also, provided that you can hit that, And once you have applied to the FAA and FCC, you can't make any changes until you've got permission. But at that point, once you've got permission, you can turn off the LA-10 marker lights. Just turn them completely off. So that's allowed. Now, you also have to have today's configuration. So you take one of the older towers. I know, Kirk, you and I are familiar with one in the Nashville area that's got it's an 800-foot tower. It's got one medium-intensity beacon on the top. It's got four levels of marker lights underneath. So they couldn't just do away with those four levels of markers. They must configure that system. It would be an A3 system. You'd have a single beacon on top. And then at the one-third and two-thirds mark, you would have two medium-intensity beacons on either side of the tower to provide a 360-degree view.
Yeah.
But if you can meet those, then it makes sense to do away with those marker lights, because now you're cutting down on your maintenance cost, your number of climbs. So it's a good thing for a tower owner to do. Another thing that they did is and when I say old days, we're talking less than a year ago. your white lighting for day, once you got to the 500-foot mark, then you had to step from medium intensity up to high intensity once you breach that and go up over 500 feet. Okay. Mm. So what they've done now is to change this. So your medium intensity dual systems, white day, red night, and your medium intensity white systems, which is a D system, is 24-hour white. The top threshold now extends to 700 feet. So if you, in the days of yore, less than a year ago, if you've got a 650-foot tower and you paint that structure and put red lights on it to avoid the cost of maintenance or the cost of installation for a high-intensity strobe system. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you can refile on that tower, get a D or an E grant for that, and you can put up the medium-intensity system. Costs are less than a third of the high-intensity system, and the maintenance is much less expensive, too.
Interesting. So I do know of a 650-foot tower that I'm not responsible for, but someday I may be. And it's red lights and painted red and white, and it could either use some paint or it could use a new lighting system. You're saying I might be able to go with a medium intensity system there instead of having to shell out the big money for a high intensity system.
Absolutely. And I should have mentioned, as you referred to just now, the acceptable means of day marking are white flashing lights or orange and white paint bands. So you've got one or the other. There are cases, of course, where you can use both, but normally it's one or the other. One thing back to those shorter towers, once you start to flash, now today's world, under 350 feet, or any time that you have a steady burn L810 side marker light, smaller marker light, steady burn. If it fails, that is not a NOTAM or NOTAM, which is notice to airmen, to the FAA. They give that notice to pilots to let them know that there's an unmarked structure in the area to avoid. But when one of those burns out, now you correct that as soon as possible. But it's not a NOTAM-worthy event. If it's flashing, however, once you start flashing that marker, then it's considered a flashing light. It is a NOTAM-worthy event to the FAA.
Oh. Wow, okay.
Yeah, big thing, big thing.
Hey, I want to pull Chris Tobin in here for a minute. Chris, you've been involved with the operational procedures at plenty of stations in a pretty large market there. Do you have stations there that own their own? I guess you do have stations that own their towers. The AM stations typically do. FMs may have a shared responsibility, or just look to the actual tower owner on top of a building. Kind of fill us in on what you've seen in the New York area in relation to what Richard's talking about here.
Well, in the New York area, yes, there are many towers that radio stations actually own and operate. There are some that they lease the space, so they're co-located with other operators. So the owner of the tower is responsible. And it's typically a letter, a memorandum of agreement between the parties, so that it's understood that the broadcaster does not need to make notices, but the owner does and is responsible. But most broadcasters usually monitor it anyway. Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, there are some folks that do and don't, but I know I worked in several places here in the city where even though we were not responsible, but the landlord was, we always made it a point to find a way to keep an eye on things just in case. Because it's life safety. You know, that's what it comes down to. It's life safety. So the last thing you need to hear is the FAA or FCC calling up and saying, what's going on, guys? So it's people's going to be proactive. But it's a mixed bag.
Yesterday, Richard and I were talking about some special cases that you have in big, big cities where you have a tower on top of a skyscraper building and mm-hmm. about how the rules apply differently. And Richard, I'd like you to – I just thought it was a very interesting point that those of us from the flatlands in the middle of America, you know, we don't have many skyscrapers. I mean, in Nashville, we've got a couple of you know, tall buildings, but not like New York City. And how the lighting system there, how they consider that. Where do you start counting the feet? Do you want to have a flashing beacon that all it does is illuminate the offices in the building next to it? Probably not. So tell us, Richard, about some of those interesting rule exceptions.
Yeah, that's very true. The FAA works with the information that you give them. I want to stress that because I want to come back to it. But if you're, you know, looking at a tall building in a city, let's take the Trump Tower in Chicago, for instance, which is pretty close to the Willis Tower, used to be called the Sears Tower. Well, if you put lighting at every level on that structure, the way the book reads, you're going to be flashing lights into office buildings during the day. It's a big nuisance to do it that way to the other people, the surrounding buildings. So the FAA will tell you once you've applied, if you tell them the information on the surrounding structures, they'll make a determination that's suitable for that area. Now, for instance, of course, the old World Trade Center towers that are no longer there, of course, we worked with those. And they had lighting on top of the structure. One of those towers had a 350-foot mast on top. I think it, regardless, it's a broadcast mast. And so that mast was actually lit as if it were a 350-foot structure on the ground. So the idea behind that was to keep away as much nuisance lighting as possible from the nearby buildings. The second part of that, though, is I've worked, on a tower farm not far from where I am in Florida, and one owner has a 280-foot structure with a determination that says you've got to mark in light. Within 150 feet, 300 feet with no lighting, and he's complaining about that. So I go to the FAA, and I start to look at the FCC. The documentation that was submitted on each floor. The taller tower showed the surrounding towers. There are three 1,200-foot or in excess of 1,200-foot broadcast towers on the same farm. So he made his case and showed geographically where his tower set that an aircraft would have to be in extreme distress before it would even approach his light. The aircraft's coming down anyway. Mm-hmm. Or his tower. The owner of the shorter tower just filed the information, gave no supporting documentation, so the FAA and FCC took that as if it were the only tower on the site. Now, to his argument, he says, okay, why didn't they look in their records to take a look and see what's around the structure? And I said, look, it's a government agency working on a short staff. They don't have the time. They don't have the resources to go digging, so they're going to work on the information that you send. It's a good note for people when they make their applications.
That's interesting. Yeah, got to make it easy for them because they're not going to go checking out. You know, I wonder what's around him. Oh, look, there's tall. No, nah. Chris. Yeah, so Chris exactly. Tobin, what Richard said. How's that compare with what you notice in New York City with the building tops and tower structures?
Oh yeah, they definitely the building owners the rooftop managers do work with the government agencies to keep the lighting from getting crazy. Out in the Meadowlands, in the early days when the strobes were coming out and people were using strobes during the day for the white light daylight, every so often the strobes would turn on at night and they'd light up the landscape. So folks in the broadcast community in the New York City area for years have been very conscientious of how they do lighting on the structures, especially in Midtown on top of the Condé Nast building or Empire, and now the New World Trade Center, Liberty Center. So, you know, it's been interesting.
Wow. So, Richard, we veered off your path, your carefully chosen path of what to talk about next, and I think there was another topic you were going to jump into.
Yeah, basically, it really flows in with the same when we're talking about the NOTAMs, Notice to Airmen. When you file those, of course, you're keeping the skies safe. You're trying to keep the pilots and any surrounding aircraft in that vicinity aware of the fact that you don't have a marked structure out there. So the FCC watches this as well, though. So you file your NOTAM with the FAA. That NOTAM is good for 15 days, and then it automatically closes if you're not renewing that. You can get those open for a longer period of time, but you have to have substantiating information that tells the FAA why they should keep this NOTAM open longer to begin with. But normally it closes in 15 days, or you can bring it back around. But every time you extend that NOTAM, the FAA sends a notification to the FCC. So if you're trying to stay away from the NOVs and the NOLs, notice of violation, notice of liability, any kind of inquiry from the FCC, if you want to try to avoid that, then it behooves you to get that NOTAM closed as soon as possible. So again, maintenance is now back into, and of course this touches in our field, but maintenance is now back in the advisory circular. Just issue, and this is one of the things that does affect all tower owners. In Section 4 of the latest issue, maintenance is spelled out. One of the things that they being the FAA, have required now is a lens inspection. The lens inspection should be performed at maximum intervals of 24 months. So at a minimum of every 2 years, you need to go up and look at that lens. My suggestion is you take photographic evidence that you've cleaned the lens, replaced it, you've got a nice clear lens with no obstruction in front of it. Lamp life is also included in this. If you've got incandescent lamps, they should be replaced at 75% of their stated lifetime. Strobe tubes, those are the xenon flashing tubes, the gas tubes, they should be replaced at the intervals according to the manufacturers. And the manufacturer tells you the strobe tube is good for 2 years. That's pretty common industry standard. Those should be replaced on a two-year interval as well. So now, of course, and this is one thing that you want to take a look at. So you've got a tall broadcast tower. Now, if you're looking at the shorter towers, you're looking at, let's say, a 500-foot tower. It's going to have one beacon on top, two on the sides. But when you go to a 750-foot tower and you've got high-intensity lighting on there and maybe red lighting at night, you've got 5 flash heads per tier, and you've got 3 tiers. Now we've got 15 lights up there or beacons to worry with.
Wow.
If you've got an appurtenance or a top-mount antenna that's taller than 40 feet, affixed to the top of the tower, then there's an AOL beacon on top of that. So here we are with just on a 750 footer. So you go to now you're looking at 29 of these, 29 to 30 of the flash heads that you have to take care of. So if you only fix each one of those beacons upon fail, it's like driving down the road and realizing all of your tires are completely worn out and you have a flat on one. So you go in and buy one tire. You wait till another tire goes out, then you have another flat. So you can handle it that way, but it's more trips. It's more climbs on the structure. The optimum way, and of course I'm drawing from past experience with a lighting company where we had a full complement on service, and we actually sold service contracts, and we had warranty contracts. So it behooved us to find the least expensive method to take care of that tower. We're getting paid the same amount each month regardless. We make our money by finding the savings. So we did full tower preventative maintenance. So you're getting every beacon on the same duty cycle. Now, they're not all going to last that specified amount of time, and you're going to have some problems in between with some of those beacons. But for the most part, you've got everything on the same duty cycle, fewer climbs, fewer NOTAMs, fewer NOTAM extensions to the FCC for them to see, and fewer shutdowns. So if you've got licensees or other permittees on that structure, you don't have to ask them to shut down their antennas because climbers typically do not climb through RF. So if you're in sweeps or that type of thing, it just makes a lot more sense to go for the full PM.
Wow.
Something to think about. And I came from the world where we'd replace a light when it burned out because we weren't going to spend, and they usually asked me to do it first. No,
yeah.
I got to get a tower crew to do this. Chris Tobin, I want to hear a bit from you after our break. And then Richard, I'd like to hear more from you about this idea of, preventive maintenance versus replacement. That's been a topic that you've hit on pretty well and have some experience with. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. Glad that you're along. Chris Tobin is with us from a recording studio. I'd love to hear more about that. Don't know if we'll have time, though. And Richard Hickey with Highlights Incorporated is our guest, and he's talking to us about some new rules from the FAA about tower lighting, and they and are encompassing some more things like actually scheduling your maintenance. I want to know if that's – is that required this is what we suggest you do before we make it law. We'll get back to that, Richard, in just a second. I want to hear that about after our break. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at the Telos Alliance. And here's what Telos – they asked me to talk to you about a newsletter that they send out. It's once a week. And, hey, should you get excited about a newsletter? Well, if it contains really cool info, then yeah. So there's this newsletter that Telos puts out. We've got a full-time person and contributing writers who contribute to this. I mean, it's really like a little publication operation going on here. It's called Direct Current. Direct Current. And we'll put the link in the show notes about how to get to it. And maybe I think I sent a link off to Suncast here to show it as well. Yeah, here we go. This is the most recent edition of Direct Current. It comes in your email, but you can also look at it on the website. And usually there's anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5 stories in Direct Current. Here's the first one here is Radio Rises from the Rubble. This is written by industry writer Tom Vernon. Yeah, Tom works with us to write stories that are of interest to broadcasters. So Telos helps an Oklahoma station following a tornado. So you can read all about that. Of course, there is news about our own equipment there, but what better way to find out the details on Telos, Omnia, Axia equipment from a newsletter where we're pointing out the things that are actually helpful. Look, this is not, I guess some people would look at it as a sales piece, but I look at it as this is news. And so here's Corny Gould. Now, I've never done a video with Corny before, but a couple of weeks ago, I had the chance to sit down with Corny. We talked about the Omnia 11 and his new G-Force software that can go into it. And so here's a story about it and a link to the video with Corny talking about it. More than that, though, I know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of radio stations getting G-Force in their Omnia 11. Well, how do you set it up? Would you like to call our support department and talk to them, or maybe even have to wait for a call back from them? Or would you like to just watch it's about a 10-minute video about how to set up G-Force? Well, I recorded Corny doing that, and the way we make you aware of that is right here in Direct Current. There's a story about how to set up G-Force in Direct Current. Also, our continuing series about streaming. This is fairly non-product specific education about setting up internet audio streaming. It's actually a 14-part course called Streaming University. We're reminding you in this episode, edition of Direct Current about chapter number 8 in Streaming University. And then here's we always have a kicker story, or try to. Here's a story about the 1940 Republican National Convention and how that telecast was anything but conventional. There's even a diagram. I think it's in this story. I saw that we put it on Facebook, a diagram of the microphone placement throughout the convention hall that NBC engineers set up. So we're taking it all the way back to 1940. What is that, 85 years ago? No, 75 years ago, 76 years ago to the 1940 RNC and how that worked technically. So this is an awesome publication. We put a lot of effort into it, and we'd like to share it with you. So if you're not subscribing to it, please do. I'll have a link in the show notes where you can go to telosalliance.com and under the blogs and such, just look for Direct Current or contact us. There's a thing under contact us. Fill out a little short form about who you are and what your email address is, and we'll put you on the list and send you Direct Current. We'll stop anytime, of course. It's easy, one-click unsubscribe. And I think you're going to enjoy it. I enjoy reading this every week, and I know that our folks put a lot of effort into it. So please check it out. Direct Current from the Telos Alliance. I thank them for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're on show number 313 of This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin's along, and Richard Hickey is here, too. We're talking about new tower regulations, including admonitions to maintain. Richard, what weight of law do these suggestions for, like, replacing your incandescent bulbs at 75% of their rated life? Is that a law, or is that just, we really think you ought to do this?
Well, again, it's in Chapter 4 of the new AC70/7460-1 HILM. So it's stated, so it is law according to the FCC. Mm. So now, how do you want to use that? Do you want to, you've got to look at some things. Let's say that you're, and this is an industry standard, but your rated lamp life on those great big lamps inside the 300 millimeter incandescent beacons. Okay. Yeah. Rated life typically is 2000 hours. So a lot of people just get out the calculator and divide 2000 by 24. And then, you know, of course, 24, they, you know, sometimes it's a month and then the years, and they try to decide how many days, how many months they can keep that bulb burning. So keep in mind that if you've got a photocell in that system, your lighting is turned on, usually photocell and controller. It's normally turned on 12 hours a day, okay? The actual on time for those lamps is about half that 12 hours because they're flashing. So they've got time off, time on. So it's more like 6 hours a day. So you can stretch the value, and that's a true thing. I mean, the FAA and FCC experts realize that this is true maintenance on there. The idea is public safety. The entire idea with all of these ideas is public safety. Let's keep the skies safe, so we're going to make sure that the owner of the structure inspects the lens, that they replace the lamps when you know, when they should be replaced, that they're not just abandoning the tower structure itself. So that's the whole key to this, is just public safety. That's all.
Well, by the way, if you do that math, that 2,000 hour life divided by 6 hours a day is 333 days, and then times 0.75 for 75% of the life, you're just at 250 days. That's less than a year, isn't it?
It is.
Figured that wrong. So, I mean, a guy like me might try to stretch that to a year. But and what that tells me is no less often than once a year you need to replace all those incandescent bulbs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, and, if you go to the newer migratory bird configuration, and if you're doing 30 flashes a minute, most of those incandescent systems were set up on controllers that flash at 20 flashes per minute, because the old requirement was 20 to 40. So now you're going to speed it up by 10. You're going to cut the lifespan of that incandescent even further. As we know from playing with lights when we were kids, you flip the switch on and off, on and off, on and off, you blow a bulb. Filament just doesn't like that. It likes to remain hot, or it likes to go cool. These lamps are designed to fluctuate back and forth, but they can be overstressed by the flash rate.
You ever, and maybe Chris Tobin remembers this, every once in a while I read, they have an update on that story of that light bulb that's in that firehouse. It's been burning for like 106 years or something like that. And I'm thinking, 106 years being that, I think it's lasted longer on than it would have if it was off. But can I get one of those bulbs for my tower lights? I don't think so.
Well, actually, if you look at some of the structures, let's say in England, where there is no flashing medium intensity red, it's steady burn. Everything's steady burn. And those incandescent lamps do last 2-3 years over there. So they last a lot longer in the steady burn mode.
Wow.
You're dealing with the laws of physics. That tungsten element heats up, it expands, it contracts, it can expand, it contract. That's what you're running up against.
True.
Richard, we've been talking primarily here about incandescent and strobe. What about LED bulbs? What are you finding there? Are there rules in here in the AC or in these rules that address the longevity of LED bulbs?
Well, most LED systems today that are produced out there, and they're actually warranted for 5 years. And across the board, this is kind of an industry standard. So they're warranted for 5 years. They're designed to go for 10 years minimum without service. Now, whether that's accomplished or not, sometimes yay, sometimes nay. But for the most part, it looks we're just basically 3 years into the LED revolution as far as high intensity. And they're looking good at this point. They really are. So same kind of thing would apply, but not, there's not a replacement for the LED because it's not called a lamp and it's not called a strobe tube. It's not a flash tube. It's not a lamp. So it's not actually in the verbiage of chapter 4.
Interesting. Wow. So, hey, Chris, any comments at this point before we move on to this notion of do we do preventive or do we replace at some point?
No. We've hit all the topics. I mean, I could say that one of the stations I worked at years ago, we had three towers on the property, a 475-foot FM, and then two towers for the AM. It was AM directional. The towers were close enough that I was actually able to get the lighting on the lower towers. The AM towers were, I think, 180 feet each. Got that turned off so the larger tower was my main illumination and marker for aviation. So that was a good thing. So we had savings there. But we did change the beacons and stationary lights, the L10s, I think yearly, even though we probably didn't have to. We did it because I looked at what the cost would be if they went out. We had to get the replacement right away, or if the FCC decided to press their thumbs against our neck and say, okay, folks, this is what we're going to get for a violation. So I weighed the cost of that, and I told the owner, I said, here's your choice. And he's like, you know what? We'll just do it once a year. Budget for it and be done with it. paid off. I know, but at the same time, also, let's be straight about it. You change out the beacons, you do work on that, but you also inspect your tower. So it's more than just go up, climb, turn bulb out, and come back down. You do a complete inspection. So you're getting your money's worth.
Yeah. Glad they looked at it that way.
That's a classic example of preventative maintenance, Chris, that you were exercising there. And at that point, you're scheduling when you're going to do that climb, what else you're going to do on the structure at the same time. You're not waiting for fate to control you.
Yes, and I can tell you that I took advantage of that scheduled time yearly. We always did it during the summer months, so it was more convenient for the crew. And I would get stuff done on the tower. We put up antennas. We did cable changes. We did stuff, and just in the auspices of the preventive maintenance of the tower lightings. And accounting was more than happy to say that's for tower lighting. It's FCC requirement, FAA. We have to do it. So the accountants were like, "Oh, it's federally regulated. Then do it. Here's the money." So that was my case. That's how I went about it. And in the long run, it paid off. So that's something to consider when you're trying to justify a tower climb and somebody says, it's just a light bulb. What's the big deal? And again, it's life safety is the big deal. But take advantage of the fact that you can do other things, and it's well worth it. And if you schedule it, you probably can get a good deal from your climbers because they know it's coming up. They'll work with you, and you don't have to worry about that inconvenience fee because you're calling them on a Friday for a job on Monday.
Richard, I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but we're going to have to wrap up in the next 12 minutes or so. So we need to hit this uh, this thing, this these ideas about replacement versus preventive maintenance. And you've got in one of your slides, you've got several service approaches available. When you can, I'd like to get to this idea of different types of maintenance and when replacement is triggered.
Sure thing. Sure. Yeah, for one thing, if you're looking at replacing, if you're considering replacing your tower lighting, the strobes or the incandescents with LED, and you're going to do that within the next 3 years, let's say, then the preventative maintenance is not really a good investment because you're going to install a lot of new parts that are going to be there when you take that system down and dispose of it. So in that case, I would recommend you just fix the problems until you get to the point where you can, install the new LED system. If you've got a strobe system out there, though, and it's not in your budget, you just don't see it over the horizon, and usually the horizon, the budget for those systems is 5 years, and you don't see a replacement coming down the pike for 5 years, then it makes sense to take a look at the overall PM or preventative maintenance for the entire structure. Now, it's not always possible in some budgets to take care of that entire structure. So what it may make sense to do is PM a tier of lighting. So if I've got a failure at the third level of lights up, maybe I'll have that level PM. That's better. It's still not great, but still not as good as a full tower PM. But hey, it's better. And then on the final note, if you're talking about keeping the system, you want to keep that in your portfolio, and you can only get the lights fixed as they fail, it still makes more sense to PM the single beacon that you're working on than it does just to throw a couple of parts in there and leave. If you take a look, and we've done graphs on some large studies with over 100 towers at least in their broadcast towers, if you're just band-aiding the system, you're just fixing what I call hitting the high spots, you're just fixing the immediate problem, then you're putting about 70% labor and about 30% parts investment into each light. If you're doing PMs, you're actually putting 70% parts and 30% labor. So you're actually improving that light and trying to make it, bringing it to a point where it's not going to fail as often. It's not going to give you the headaches, fewer NOTAMs, fewer shutdowns, fewer problems during sweeps. As we all know, that's when most outages seem to occur. So it really pays. It really pays to do the PM, to take a look at that preventative maintenance.
You've got a chart in your presentation, and I wish we could show this now. We really can't. Maybe I can put something like this in the show notes. But that makes a lot of sense, and it makes sense to everyone who's a broadcast engineer. If you're an engineer and you go fix a failure and find the part, replace the part of the system or fix it up, whatever it is, you've spent an enormous amount of labor to probably replace a part that didn't cost a whole lot of money, but it's keeping you off the air. Whereas if you do preventive maintenance, you're going to say, you know what, preventatively, this, and this ought to get replaced. That needs to be cleaned. And you can hit a bunch of stuff at the same time with almost the same amount of labor as the service call would have cost to get you back on the air. So that makes total sense. Put your money into parts and get those replaced and freshened, where especially ones that wear out, with a minimum of labor cost. And if you do the preventive maintenance, that's the equation that you get, instead of the, oh my gosh, we got a tube out at the top and it's going to cost us, $2,500 to have a crew climb and replace that. Well, so much of that has gone into labor. Am I saying the same thing?
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you take a look at what Chris said there, get all of that done at the same time on the tower, and he makes a good point as well. If you're calling for emergency service and you're having shut down in emergency conditions and you're having to have the crew on that tower at night, that's all of those result in upcharges in many cases, not with all companies, but with many. So it pays to schedule that maintenance. You know when you're going to be shut down. You know that you've got other things that can be done at the same time with the shutdown. And you just take care of the preventative maintenance, the lighting system. You true it up, in a sense, while you're shut down, you're on that tower.
Hey, Chris Tobin, I'll bet you there's been times when maybe you've put off some electrical work because you know it's going to take everything off the air. And then, hey, well, guess what? The tower crew's going to be on the tower. We got to shut the station off the air anyway. Let's get that electrical work scheduled at the same time so, you know, we don't have to go off the air twice, just once. Does that happen to you?
Yes, absolutely. And I worked at a directional AM where we had our Austin rings, got us our electrical onto the tower, and several of the conduits, the EMT that carried the wiring to the tower lights, had over time corroded and, you know, failed. So yeah. When we started having problems with our lighting, we did exactly that. On a Sunday morning, we scheduled a shutdown way in advance, so I didn't have to pay a premium to bring a crew out. And we took care of the electrical, took care of the lighting, took care of a few inspections on the tower. They started around 6 a.m., just about sunrise, wrapped up around noontime, 1 o'clock, and it was money well spent. And we found a few things, and it worked out. But yeah, if you plan it correctly, I think that's the best way to go about it. And preventive maintenance does save money. You just have to be, creative in how you explain it to those who don't understand. Because I have used PM schedules for a lot of projects that have paid off handsomely. Because it's one of those things you just can't account for. It's an expense that sometimes people don't understand how to account for it on the books, and it becomes this like, oh, PM, it's this and that. The reality is it does save you, and in the long run, that's what people don't realize. It's like systems reliability, right? You know, you have 5 nines, 4 nines, 3 nines. People don't get the fact that, you know, 5 nines reliability of a system or a device is like, I think, like 5 seconds or 2 minutes a year of failure expected. You know, put that in perspective. You can maintain 5 nines reliability. You're not off the air for anything other than Mother Nature, which you can't control. That saves you money. That makes the ability to make money. So that's how you have to look at it. And nowadays, you have to look at it even harder because a lot of the technologies we have, just they run if you do it right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good advice. And Richard and Chris, we're going to take one more quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to get a final word from each of you. Maybe you've got a tip or a trick, or Richard, maybe you've got a reference place that you'd like people to go to check out some of the things that you've said, maybe your company's website or any other resource you'd like to point people to. We'll say it verbally at the end of the show, and we'll also put it in the show notes afterwards. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 313 with Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and Richard Hickey of High Lights Incorporated. They are a tower maintenance installation company. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo and the Lavo Crystal Clear. You know, everywhere you go, you find touchscreens. Now, there's your smartphone and tablet, of course. Supermarket checkouts have touchscreens. Laptops now are coming with them, or they're optional. And so do the radios and new cars have touchscreens. Even airplane cockpits have them, too. Touchscreens make sense because they're simple and they're natural. And their intuitive controls help you finish tasks faster. Well, with fewer errors. Isn't it time that you brought the power of touch into your radio studio? Well, you can with the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console from Lavo. Crystal Clear gives you your talent an instantly understandable multi-touch interface. Faders, meters, clocks, timers, talkback, and more all live in harmony on a single screen, so shows run smoother and they sound better. Crystal Clear features Lavo's exclusive Auto Mix. Now, that's the hands-free, smart mixing algorithm designed for fast-paced multi-mic talk shows. And another feature called Auto Gain. Just push a button, and the preamp calibrates automatically while your guest is speaking in the microphone. So you don't have that blast of an overdriven preamp or one that's too low. You don't have enough fader gain. Sets it automatically. With so much advanced automation, talent can dock those mixing controls over to the side. Yeah, put the console away and use the screen to do other things like working with delivery systems, audio editors, or even phone systems. Crystal Clear's power plant measures just one rack unit. That's pretty amazing when you consider the staggering amount of DSP on board. You get compression, EQ, voice processing, and precision delay that can be applied to all of the mic, line, and digital sources. Optional upgrades include redundant power, MADI, and Ravenna and AES-67. All of this power costs no more than you'd spend for an ordinary console. So if you're thinking of buying a new console, don't decide before you check out Crystal Clear from Lavo. Go to www.lavo.com, and read about it, or call in the U.S. Bill Bennett. He's at Lavo USA. The number is 888-810-4468, 888-810-4468. To find out more, the future is clear. It's Lavo Crystal Clear. Thanks very much to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin, Bill Hickey, Richard Hickey are along. Let's see if we can get a tip out of. Let's go to Richard first. Richard, you got something you'd like for our listeners and viewers to go, aha, that guy is smart. He gave me this great idea.
Well, actually, you know, almost everything in this industry is dictated by regulations from the FAA, FCC, and a few things that just, you know, come from common sense and experience. And we've got a lot of those tools to draw from. What I would encourage is if you have a question, first off, don't panic. This is normally it's easy to work through. If you have an issue with the FAA or FCC, I've got contacts on both sides that it's a kinder, gentler government that we deal with these days. Seriously, they are they're really good to deal with. So with any of those, you know, if you have those questions, it's just email me at rhickey@highlightsinc.com, and I'll be glad to help you with those.
Okay, cool. All right. And, hey, I'll hit you by email. We want to figure out a link or a resource or two to put into the show notes, or I can find a couple things and put them in the show notes, too. I like for people to be able to click on those show notes and not have to write something down while they're driving listening to this episode of the show. Good deal. You guys are the experts, and I was looking over some of those rules. I'm thinking, I don't know what half the stuff is referring to. I mean, I wish they'd use, you know, common words like I know, but LA-10 and yeah. You need somebody to help you hold your hand on that. Chris Tobin, you have a final parting word or a tip for us this week, buddy?
Yes, actually two. First one is last week I was involved in a tower inspection here in the city on top of a building. And Tom Sullivan and Sean Cooper from ERI were the ones who did the work. So anytime you have a chance to see Tom work and climb a tower, you make sure you come out and watch. One of the things that he reminded me of, and I totally agreed, was I have several GPS antennas mounted on the structure for the HD radio and other things. So I've labeled them. So if you have a site where you've got antennas outside your building, outside of the standard, you know, the FM, the AM stuff, but like GPS or maybe a RPU or land mobile radio, something of that sort, it wouldn't hurt to label and tag them. So when you're out there and on the rooftop or have somebody servicing, they disconnect the correct one. Now, my GPS antenna is on a parapet, on a catwalk, that is, with 12 other GPS antennas used by federal agencies, city agencies, and other broadcasters. And all of them look the same, you know, that little dome. And I realized looking at it going, you know, it's real easy for somebody to take the wrong one out. And so I labeled it up. So the tip is label your items that stick outside your building where it's possible that someone who's not familiar with your setup, or if you're co-located or you share the site, you know, label the stuff. It's very important. And when I say label it, make sure you put the call letters of the station, a contact name, and the room and floor that your the equipment, the antenna goes back to, just in case they happen to be your neighbors, and then you know. And the other tip was, since we're talking tower lighting and tower structures, during the same inspection, it was the rooftop manager, who's a broadcast engineer, reminded the tower guys, when you take the bulbs, the lenses off, use some petroleum jelly on the threads and put them back on so they can be removed later in the year.
Ah, so this is for both side lights and for
everything, yes, for the beacon, side lights, the whole bit. Well, some of the beacons are they have a captive hinge, so some of the beacons you don't do that, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. Richard, anything wrong with putting a little petroleum jelly on there? Is that the thing to do?
I don't see anything wrong with it immediately. You know, it would also prevent some water ingress into the socket. Sounds like a good idea.
I used to just spin on it and lubricate it, but that I got shocked one time, and that was no good. Now I'm kidding. I can't tell you how many, and I've changed a lot of bulbs. I can't tell you how many of those, you know, incandescent bulbs where the glass just twists off and you're left with, oh, great. You know, now I got to get some pliers and dig that metal out of the socket. I never had a problem with the 300-millimeter code beacons, though. You know, the bayonet, you know, push in, turn a quarter turn, pull it out. Those never seized up on me, but yeah. Good ideas, gentlemen. Thanks very much. Chris Tobin has been with us, and so has Richard Hickey from Highlights. Richard, thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you.
And Chris Tobin, thank you for being on the show as well. Glad you took the time to be here today. And can you give us a little 30-second as to That room that you're in? That's pretty
cool. Oh, sure, sure. This is a multi-track production studio for a premier jazz station here in New York City, WBGO. And it's a DMX R100 Sony digital audio mixer, or desk, depending on where you are in the world. And this is where many recordings are made, jazz recordings from professionals to those coming up in the ranks. And a lot of stuff has been done the last couple of months out of this room. So if you tune in to the station or check out the website, you'll hear a lot of the recordings that are done. Neumann mics, and AKG, and a few others are used. And there's a Steinway piano in the performance studio, along with a B3 Hammond organ. So it's a lot of great stuff comes out of this room.
You know, it's nice that recording studios don't make artists bring their own pianos in.
Well, there are some keyboardists that come in with their electric keyboards, but yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you're right, And then
there's also a drum set. There's a drum set available, and there's a couple of bass amps. So, yeah, you can do a little bit of both.
I could let my five-year-old loose on that drum set.
Yes. Oh, it's fun stuff.
Oh, it's been a good show. Richard, thanks very much for being here, and you too, Chris. And we're going to go. Thanks to Suncast, our producer back in New York, for putting the show together. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, back from vacation. He's sunned, he's tanned, he's rested, he's ready to go, producing lots of other podcasts on this very network. I'd like you to check out What the Tech. That's always a lot of fun here on the GFQ network. That's it. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.